Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
In 2022, Team Milk came together by sponsoring female marathon runners for the marathon in New York City. Today, they're more than 20,000 strong. In 2024, Team Milk is making an even bigger commitment to female runners and launching the only women's marathon in the U.S., designed for and by women. The inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Hello and happy 2018, everybody. This is Evan, your long-form podcast co-host. Max, Aaron, and myself are off this week, so we're sending you an episode from the archives. This is Ben Taub from 2016. Ben is a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. He's done a lot of international reporting. You'll hear him talk about ISIS. You'll hear him talk about his incredibly wrenching story around doctors in Syria. Since this episode's come out, he's also done big stories, including one on the humanitarian crisis in Chad and another about human trafficking. I recommend you check both of those out. This is one of my favorite interviews that I've ever conducted for the podcast, both because Ben has a really fascinating and fun and self-starting way that he got into journalism, and because he's also extremely thoughtful about how he approaches his work. I hope you'll enjoy it if you haven't heard it already. If you have, I hope you enjoy revisiting it. We'll be back with a new episode next week.
Okay, Ben. Ben Taub, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for coming in here. It's funny that we're having you on now, actually, because we had Mr. David Remnick on just a couple of weeks ago. He did not name check that many writers in the course of the podcast, but you were one of them. And he brought up your name as an example of like being on the lookout for and identifying talented writers and diligent reporters, and how he has to sort of always be open to people who might be someone who could write for The New Yorker, you know, someone who could produce something great. And so that leads me to want to know how you got to the point where you got identified in that way by someone who then pointed you out to David Remnick. So I think it would be really interesting to know, because you're at the early part of your career, how this career kind of like got going to begin with.
Well, in 2011, during the Arab Spring, I made a very rash decision that I don't regret at all, which was I was a sophomore in college, and I had met this girl who was a few years older who was moving to Cairo for the summer to work for a refugee rights organization. And her plans had, you know, ossified long before the Arab Spring, but she was going to go irrespective of what was happening.
So this was right after the Arab Spring. This would be the summer after the Arab Spring.
Exactly. And her workplace was two blocks from Tahrir Square. And her apartment that she was renting was half a block from the Ministry of Interior, you know, right around the corner. And so it was an area of some excitement. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Egypt, and I didn't tell my university, and I didn't tell my family, because I was nervous about making them nervous. You know, Egypt was on the front page of the Times every day with, you know, quite scary pictures. And I had never been outside of the U.S. or Western Europe. Huh. And I wanted, I sort of primarily went to see her, but I also wanted to see what was going on. And I conflated the excitement of being in love with someone for the first time with the excitement of the Arab Spring and couldn't really parse those two experiences. And, you know, of course, the relationship sort of fizzled out over the ensuing months, but I retained this fascination with what was going on in Egypt. And so when I came back to school, I came back and decided to enroll in a journalism class.
And you were at Princeton?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And they have a small journalism program where basically every semester they bring in four or five reporters or editors from who basically take a semester of leave from their various jobs. And this semester they had Deborah Amos from NPR come in, and she covers the Middle East for NPR. And so I enrolled in her class, and I enrolled in an investigative reporting class with Joe Stevens from The Post, just trying to sort of find what I was interested in.
Do you have any journalists in your family or in your,
no.
in your background?
I'm not aware of any, yeah. No. My dad's a pianist. And I had spent most of college to this point thinking that I would want to become a musician or an actor, and also studying philosophy and thinking maybe that I would want to go to grad school for that. I was really captivated by moral philosophy. And so I took Deb Amos's class and sort of never looked back after that. She was someone who, after each lesson, I just wanted to live some approximation of her life. And she was a really kind mentor. And so I took a year off school after that. And ultimately traveled to the Middle East, and she guided me a lot of the way.
When you went to the Turkish-Syrian border for the first time, what was your sort of, in your mind, your stated aim?
So essentially the plan was to try to learn about the war, but also to learn about how people report it. And so the idea was that I would live in this border town for, it was called Kilis. Mm-hmm. And so Kilis is a very, very small town. There were two hotels very close to each other that were just, you know, absolutely dreadful places. My room cost about $12 a night, and it's about 3 kilometers north of Syria, and it's at a major crossing point for Aleppo. So all the jihadis, all the weapons that are shoveled across the Turkish-Syrian border basically go through Kilis crossing or through Bab al-Hawa, which is a few miles to the west. And I thought that I would just sort of hang out and meet people there, a lot of the time the intention was to meet journalists who are covering the war and who are going into Aleppo, and sit down with them over beers and talk about their security precautions, how they plan trips, what they look for when they're on the ground, how they work so that they don't endanger fixers or other locals that they encounter, and whether after a decade or 15 years of covering conflict, they feel as though it's taken a toll on them that is or isn't worth it. And so it was really, more than anything, trying to figure out whether this is something that I was cut out for, or whether it was something that I even wanted to do. And what I was really captivated by was meeting a lot of people who I felt shouldn't have been there. Kind of in a way that I shouldn't have been there,
mm-hmm.
but they were less aware of that, of the fact that they shouldn't have
been there. You wrote about some of these people for the Daily Beast, right?
Yeah, there were a lot of people who were going into Syria for really dark reasons that they had difficulty explaining.
Yeah.
People that just kind of wanted to see violence, sometimes participate in it for no real reason, no ideological reason. You know, not necessarily fighters, but just kind of war tourists. And I don't know. There were a lot of really dark things going on in this town.
And then later you wrote about meeting Stephen Sotloff and, mm-hmm. you know, what happened to him. And was that that summer that you met him?
Yeah, it was that summer. So between March and June of 2013, ISIS started its trend of kidnapping.
Yeah.
They kidnapped about half a dozen guys, like, in May and June alone. And so I had resolved that I wasn't going to cross. I was just going to stay and try to understand this town. And, you know, there was a handful of Syrian guys who were bringing journalists in. They all knew each other. They all knew who each other were. Some of them trusted each other a little bit. Some of them purported to be friends. By the time Stephen Sotloff came to town, I had been there for 6 weeks, and I had seen a lot of really close calls with abduction.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Canadian who was targeted for abduction and who left sort of just in time after me and one other person intervened.
This was the photographer?
Yeah. Having found out that he had been targeted with certainty, we got a note from someone in Aleppo saying, yeah, they know where his hotel room, they know his hotel room number, they know he's meeting this fixer tomorrow at 10 a.m. You know, with armed with that information, he finally agreed to go home and he left. But, I sat down with Stephen over beers and we talked about all of these things that had happened and all the crazy people that were going in. And there was a Japanese war tourist who was running around sort of half taking pictures, half shooting guns for fun. Like, we talked about all these stuff and kind of laughed them off and said, isn't it all terrible and dark and isn't it all sad? Because ultimately, this is all done at the expense of Syrian civilians. And it's particularly jarring to watch how little a lot of people noticed that or considered that when they were planning their trips. And Stephen told me his war stories from Yemen and from Egypt and from Libya and his prior complications with his travel into Syria. And I was very surprised when 3 days later someone came out of Aleppo and asked me if I had heard about this fixer that was missing. And that was the same fixer that the Canadian had sought out. It was the same fixer that Sotloff and I had discussed, and I told him not to go with because he was being followed from the Canadian's sort of blunders.
It was the same, same reason the Canadian had been warned off,
yeah,
is that this fixer was potentially
The fixer was
compromised.
The fixer himself was not at all thought to be involved in selling anyone out, but he was likely being followed. And so I was very surprised when the fixer was missing. I wrote to Stephen on Facebook and I was like, hey man, you know, Yusuf's disappeared. His wife's looking for him. Let me know if you hear anything. And I hope to grab beers when you get out of Aleppo soon. And the message showed up red and he didn't reply. But I figured internet's bad. He's very busy. He's got other things to worry about. And the following day I found out that they had been kidnapped together. And my heart sank. I just had this feeling of utter terror and emptiness and confusion and fear because I had another friend who was still in Aleppo who had to get out and she was planning to come out in 2 or 3 days. So I felt as though I couldn't leave even though I felt as though I should leave.
That you might be targeted at this point because of a connection.
It didn't occur to me until about 3 a.m. that night when I finally was so exhausted that I had to go to sleep. And I lay down in my bed, you know, about to close my eyes, and I realized that the message I had sent him had been read and that 3 messages earlier we exchanged hotel room numbers. And so I had written to whoever was reading Sotloff's messages that I was in room 507 at the Hotel Istanbul in Kilis. And I was just terrified. And I went to bed that night thinking that there was a pretty reasonable chance that I would get abducted in the middle of the night. This was not a hotel in the traditional sense that it was, you know, There were guys hanging out in the lobby all day, sort of texting. And one of the widespread, not just rumors, but likelihoods, was that journalists were being monitored in Kilis and aid workers were being monitored in Kilis so that when they crossed the border, which is about a 30-minute process of walking through 3 big Turkish checkpoints, and then, you know, there's one road that you take to get to Aleppo, someone can phone ahead saying, okay, he's coming, he looks like this, he's carrying a brown bag, and he'll be there in 40 minutes. And then people would get picked up very quickly upon crossing the border. But if you get into a car on the Turkish side, someone can get you into Syria pretty easily against your will through the various smuggling points. And I woke up the next day, and fortunately, my friend who was stuck in Aleppo managed to make it out. She barely did. She had to go through an ISIS checkpoint wearing a niqab and pretending to be her fixer's wife. Mm. And her fixer was driving with both windows down at this checkpoint with a grenade next to the handbrake so that they could toss it out of either window if they had to and just floor it. But they didn't have to. They got through and She and I spent the next 4 or 5 days hanging out in Kilis, trying to sort of pin down what had happened to Sotloff.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, this culminated with a meeting that I arranged at a point where I had totally lost perspective. I felt as though I just couldn't leave without doing everything possible to find out what had happened. And that entailed arranging a tea with a British guy who I strongly suspected was a member of ISIS,
mm-hmm.
who I'd met in a taxi about a month before, who purported to be a field doctor, but he was working in a town called Azaz that was totally under the control of the Islamic State, that a lot of foreign jihadis traveled into. It was directly off opposite Kilis. And to my mind, then and today, be completely impossible for a British doctor to have worked in Azaz at that time without being affiliated. And that was also a place where a lot of people had been kidnapped, and so I figured that he might know something.
Mm-hmm.
And so we arranged to meet up on the Turkish side on my terms at a cafe at 6 p.m. when the sun was still out. And this was an outdoor area next to a busy road where there were often Turkish military personnel and vehicles. The likelihood of open abduction was pretty much nil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could get killed in a suicide bombing, but you couldn't really get abducted without someone noticing, and they wouldn't be able to get far because there was too much traffic. So it seemed like a pretty good place to do what I felt I had to do.
Which was try to find out what this guy might know about Tiyan abduction.
And could he arrange a line of communication? Because at this point, a lot of people had been abducted, but ISIS hadn't yet made any demands.
Right, this is before the videos.
A year before the videos. Yeah. A year before really anyone knew about this, because a lot of journalists agreed to sort of keep a media blackout with an idea that families were certainly trying to negotiate and figure out what had happened and do anything they could to release governments with mixed commitments, perhaps. And so everyone sort of kept this media blackout, even though we all knew, too, that it seemed to be contributing to abductions, because a lot of people were going in without knowing that there had been trends of abductions in the same towns that they were about to visit.
Mm.
So this was a dilemma.
So let's we'll step back for 1 second. I just want to keep in mind for people who are listening mm-hmm. to this. This is like what you're doing instead of being in college, or like right between your junior and senior years. And so you're now wrapped up in this, okay, I'm going to try to help figure out maybe if I can what happened. But how are you conceiving your role at this point? Are you thinking like, I'm going to do this and I'm going to go home and I'm never going to come back? Like, this sounds like it has the potential where you could say, I made a big mistake coming here. This is insane. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to do this anymore.
Yeah. The town and spiraled into a complete black hole. And I think so did my own grasp of what was possible, what I should be doing, whether or not I really had to be there. But I felt morally obliged. Like, I couldn't leave. I would never have forgiven myself for not trying. And I don't know. Maybe that might sound really stupid. And I think today I would have had the wherewithal and the state of mind to know that it was not my responsibility, and that I might have, if anything, maybe it's morally worse to put myself in a position where I might harm my family and people that are close to me by putting myself in a situation that I shouldn't have, and that it wasn't my role to fill. But at the time, I had just gone down the dark hole with this town, and I really felt as though this was something I had to do. And so we arranged this meeting with the British guy, and he didn't show up. And I had already packed my bags in case the meeting went badly, and I was ready to leave anyway. And I was planning to leave that night anyway, when he called again, and he called me and said, okay, like, we just had some difficulty crossing the border. I'm with a bunch of guys who, they've never met an American, they're excited to see you. You know, we're going to come take you for dinner. We'll grab you, pick you up, take you to our place, Turkish side or Syrian side, doesn't matter, but come with us. And I was like, no, you can come to the cafe as you were supposed to, but I'm not coming with you anywhere. Ultimately, he agreed to come to the cafe, but I didn't like that he was with other people because he wasn't supposed to be with other people. When he got there, I was deliberating with the other person whether or not we should go. And he called again. He said, we're at the cafe. We're parked outside. We're in the van next to the cell phone shop. Come get in the van. And I said, no, you get out of the van and we'll meet you at the cafe. And he said, no. Get in the van. And we had this back and forth for 2 or 3 minutes. And then he started shouting at me, accusing me of, you know, racism and Islamophobia for refusing to trust him. And I hung up and they sped off. There were two vans. And I had the feeling that I had narrowly avoided an abduction. So that night I left. I went to Gaziantep, an hour north, and I basically hid in a hotel room up there, you know, in a spell of darkness. And then I had a Turkish friend who lived in a place in a beautiful part of the country on the Aegean Sea, and I spent 3 days with her there, just sort of recovering, unable to grasp what had happened. And then I had a very jarring return to Princeton 2 weeks later, where I was a peer academic advisor to several freshmen who had legitimate concerns about, like, majors and classes and, like, roommates who suck. But I had a hard time filling that role. And also, of course, I couldn't talk about what had happened because there was this media blackout. And so it was really hard, and my head and my heart were still stuck on the Turkish-Syrian border as I tried to reintegrate into school.
So then, where do you go from there? Do you feel like you say you're still caught up in thinking about it? But did you think, okay, now I'm going to consider what my journalistic options could be?
At that point, I just couldn't stop looking at Syria. And it wasn't really, it was partially about the abductions, trying to figure out what had happened there, knowing, with no intention of writing about them, because there was this media blackout, and I didn't want to write about them, really. I just wanted to understand what had happened. And so I started really studying ISIS pretty closely and following it very closely. But also, I had met a lot of Syrian refugees, a lot of Syrian I've talked about fixers who were untrustworthy, but I met a lot of Syrian fixers who were really lovely, trustworthy people who had had their lives totally upended by this conflict, whose brothers and sisters had been killed or kidnapped by security services of the Syrian government. I just couldn't stop looking at Syria. So it was less about wanting to be a journalist than it was being completely unable to extricate myself from this situation. And I ended up going back to Kilis the following summer. After I graduated, I went straight back to Kilis. I spent another 2 months there. It was a totally different town. ISIS had been sort of routed out of the area by the moderate rebels. And so I was there working on a very specific project that was intended to be a piece of long-form journalism that ultimately I haven't yet written, but I think I'm probably going to. It was sort of an investigation into a very interesting con man who I became quite close to before I knew he was a con man. And I returned to Kilis to look into one of his stated projects a lot more closely. And I haven't decided whether or not I'll do anything on that.
And what was the feeling among your family and your friends at this point about what you were doing? How did you explain it to people, and what did they think?
I told my family everything about that period in real time. As the abduction stuff was going on, I checked in with them. I checked in with my two journalism professors, Deb Amos and Joe Stevens. I checked in with my philosophy professor. I told a few friends when I returned what had happened, but I couldn't. It was hard because I didn't know that many people going back to Princeton. Like, a lot of my friends had graduated. And so I was trying to make new friends, and that entailed going to parties at these eating clubs, which are in themselves, like, morally questionable institutions. And like,
the dissonance between these things must have been quite extraordinary.
It was jarring. It was very jarring, but I, you know, I had spent the previous 3 years at this school, and I knew how things worked there, and I had been as much a part of that system as all of the students who now couldn't relate to what had happened to me on the Turkish-Syrian border. And so I didn't harbor any resentment for people for not understanding. I mostly was just grateful to the few people that I felt like I could really confide in for being there.
And then at what point along the way did you say, I am also going to try out for a reality TV show?
Okay, so that was... this is a bit of a chronological mess. So
yeah, we don't need to keep the strict chronology. We just have to hit the highlights. But I'm going to say you're both the first person in over 200 episodes to say that their journalism career was commenced on the basis of a love, and then I believe the second part may also be a first.
Right. So so while I was taking my first journalism class in the spring of 2012 in Deb Amos's class, I had spent the preceding couple of years, my primary extracurricular focus was learning how to sing, and secondary one was like stage acting, both of which I cared about a lot, and both of which I frankly miss immensely now that I am really not doing them.
You've got time.
We'll see. So in 2012, one of my favorite singers was CeeLo Green. And I just admired him because he was a complete weirdo and because there was this obscure video of him singing the most complicated sequence of notes that I've heard anybody sing back then and to date. It was the only sequence of notes that were so confusing that I just, like, couldn't get it every time I wanted to. And I admired him so much. And I just loved his voice, and I loved that he was a total psycho. And so when I found out that The Voice was holding auditions, I just wanted to meet CeeLo. And so I went to the New York auditions, and it was during midterm exams. And I got there, and there was this huge line. And I went up to check in with the person at the front desk. I was like, my appointment time was for 7. It looks like there's a huge line. 7 o'clock is in 10 minutes. Like, realistically, when am I going to go? And she was like, our line's about an hour and a half. And I said, look, I have midterms. Like, I'm going back to school. And she was like, don't tell anybody. And she just put my card on top. And so I went next. And so I went in and sang this was a very preliminary stage. This was not for CeeLo or anyone else.
They have some lower level judges
producers.
Sort out people.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And so I sang 2 or 3 songs for them. And a few weeks later, I got a call saying, come out to LA. I don't know. I ended up being a contestant on the show on CeeLo's team for a couple of episodes. They aired almost none of my interviews because, for various reasons. One, I mean, I could never know the real reasons. Among them might be, were I to guess, that they kept asking me to sort of talk about Egypt and how I wanted to be a war journalist. And uh-huh. I kept saying, I'm not going to say war journalist on television. I want to be maybe a foreign correspondent. I'm interested in journalism. I'm learning about it right now, but I'm not going to say I want to be a war journalist. That's despicable. And I think I gave these really boring, rambling interviews where pretty much everything was unusable. And so I think I got a grand total of like 12 seconds of airtime between like 2 or 3 episodes. I had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah.
But like this, it wasn't me, and I was doing it kind of for fun, kind of for curiosity.
Yeah.
So I went, after the show, I went down to Atlanta, where I met up with a former professor who worked in a rap studio, So I spent about 6 weeks sort of sleeping on the floor in the spare room there and working on making original music. Not, I wasn't working on rap stuff. I was working on jazz and R&B original compositions with my former professor who, you know, I think those recordings, we made 7 or 8 songs. Probably 2 or 3 of them are decent, but only exist on our Dropboxes right now. And I just haven't returned to them. But I kind of pivoted after the new year into the trip that became the path to the Turkish-Syrian border. And I used, for that initial trip, I had saved up a bit of money from The Voice, where I didn't win anything, but they pay a stipend. And because I didn't really have that many expenses in life, I was living at home, I had saved up like $2,000 or $3,000, which traveling from Tunisia to Belarus and mostly traveling by bus and mostly sleeping either on buses or couch surfing or staying with friends, like that worked.
That got you there.
For 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Our show is brought to you today by Tripping.com. Did you know that the average family visits 5 websites before booking a vacation rental? I think that actually sounds low. Don't waste all your time planning your next trip. Have that fun relaxing with Tripping.com, the world's number one site for vacation rentals. I love vacation rentals. They offer flexibility, perks, amenities that hotels don't, multiple bedrooms, backyards, hot tubs, free Wi-Fi, even fully stocked kitchens, great for families, big groups. So whether you're looking for a cabin for New Year's Eve, actually that already passed, so you missed it if that was the truth. But next year, maybe a vacation to Hawaii or staying in Europe like a local, Tripping.com can help you find the perfect place to stay. One search lets you filter, compare, and sort over 10 million available properties on trusted sites like VRBO, TripAdvisor, Booking.com. You don't have to wonder if you're getting the best deal. You'll save an average of 18% per night by booking with Tripping.com. So go to Tripping.com/longform. You're going to save money and book the perfect vacation rental. Again, Tripping.com/longform. Thank you, Tripping.com.
So then let's fast forward to how these stories came about. Because so now you've had this like up close exposure to journalism at its extreme and actually like weirdly Hollywood at its extreme.
At its ugliest. Like, yeah. Both of them, I guess.
Yeah. And you've chosen one and you're invested in this one area. But then the next question is sort of like, how do you start a career around that? And so how did these stories come about? The first story about the teenage...
The Belgians.
Yeah.
So during the summer of 2014, when I was back in Killis, because by this point, everyone knew about the abductions and ISIS had taken Mosul. Although, to be fair, the public didn't really know about the abductions yet. A handful of families had gone public. The beheading tapes hadn't been released yet. But no journalists were coming to Killis. Like, no one was going to Aleppo because it was too dangerous. There was no reason to go to Killis if you're not going to Aleppo. So no one came. And I was hanging out there for a while. And one day I was walking down the only busy street in town. And I spotted these 2 middle-aged white guys with backpacks who were clearly out of place. And so I went up to them and I thought maybe this was sort of a remnant of the previous summer of 2 people that shouldn't be there.
War tourists.
Yeah, I didn't know. Or maybe they were very competent journalists who were just, you know, had the contacts and the logistical expertise to go to Aleppo and do it right. I didn't know. So I went up to them and I just asked them, I was like, what are you doing here?
At this point, do you introduce yourself? I'm Ben Taub. I'm a reporter.
No. I just said, I was an aspiring journalist. I was, you know, because on the off chance they were real journalists, I'm not gonna want them to call my bluff. I was like, look, I'm an aspiring journalist. I'm living here. Like, I've seen almost no one that's not Syrian or Turkish in this town. What are you doing? And they said they're from Belgium. They were fathers of young ISIS recruits, and they were traveling They were planning to go to Raqqa to try to negotiate with one of their sons to come home. And this was the strangest thing I had ever seen in Kilis. But I was, to be honest, I was really distrustful of one of them in particular because he seemed very volatile. He was spouting all these conspiracy theories about the formation of ISIS, you know, that the U.S. and the Israeli intelligence services had been involved. And this is a conspiracy that's continued to circulate throughout the region since, but it was strange coming from a European. But I took a couple of portraits of him in a supermarket and of his passports that showed all these Turkish and Syrian stamps that he had clearly actually crossed, because also people lied all the time and mm-hmm. I didn't really know if he was telling the truth. But the other father seemed more even-keeled and reliable and trustworthy, and I took their email addresses and I stayed in touch. And then I went to grad school about 3 weeks after coming back from the border. I went to Columbia for journalism school. And there's like two programs at the journalism school. One is the main journalism program. One is that's the MS program. The other is the MA program, which in theory is for journalists that have a few years of experience who then want to sort of delve into a specific subject expertise and then emerge with a long form piece of writing that they can pitch around or take a sort of next step in their careers.
Mm-hmm.
I had no career. It didn't really make any sense for me to be doing that track, but I had to do this 10,000 word project, the thesis project. And I was very fortunate to be paired with Steve Cole, who I think because of subject matter, you know, I wanted to write about ISIS or Syria or maybe Europeans joining ISIS. I didn't really know. But we all, you know, drafted our two or three ideas, and somehow I got matched with Steve, who is an expert on all of that and has, you know, decades of experience reporting investigations in the region.
Yeah, and other things besides.
He was, and so I was terrified on our first meeting because this was someone who I really deeply admired, and I'm always afraid of people that I admire. And he was so kind, and he asked me to sort of draw up a list of my ideas, and I gave him four or five, and one of them was, oh, I met these Belgian dads whose kids joined ISIS and they tried to retrieve them. And he was like, do that. So I started in Belgium. There's a very, very small community of experts who like monitor the jihadism problem. And by community, I mean there's like two guys. One of them's a journalist. One of them works in public transit, but speaks Arabic and obsessively follows ISIS Twitter. And this is, keep in mind, a year before the Paris attacks. At this point, Belgium wasn't really widely thought of as the center of European terrorism. And the only reason I had picked Belgium was not some sort of prescient understanding, but just because I met these dads. And so they were the only contacts I had. And so this public transit worker who monitors ISIS Twitter told me that there was a really interesting trial going on called the Sharia for Belgium trial, and that this group was responsible for dozens of young men being recruited and going into Syria and joining ISIS, all radicalized in a single apartment in Antwerp openly over the preceding couple of years. I made a few more calls, and someone who shouldn't have had access to a federal police investigation had this 100-page document that included wiretaps of Belgian ISIS fighters calling back to their family members and friends and bragging about committing war crimes. They described in great detail the jihadi training program they all underwent at this base in northern Syria. They talked about the emir leading their group, who ended up being largely responsible for the hostage crisis, it later emerged.
And the person who had this report, you found them by just calling?
Yeah, calling around more or less by accident and just trying to learn about jihadism in Belgium.
Just asking people, what do you know about this?
Yeah,
who else should I talk to, kind of thing?
Who should I talk to? Like, can you help me? And he had this leaked document. It had already been written about in the Belgian press, but fortunately for me, it had been written about in the Flemish press. And while a lot of people monitor the French press, this had happened in Antwerp and was really a local story. And so this incredible document and this incredible volume of information from wiretaps and from interrogations with jihadis who had returned was showing up in like the local Antwerp tabloids in Flemish, and no one saw it. And so then I spent Thanksgiving break typing 100 pages into Google Translate because it was a shitty PDF and there was no copy paste for this. And so I started learning some Flemish by typing this into Google Translate. My first word was ongelovigen, which means infidels. And my second word was ontufting, which means beheading. So I typed 100 pages into Google Translate and I gave it to Steve, and he said, okay, I'm going to call up an editor at The New Yorker. And I became terrified again, of course. And I remember going, I got on the subway to go home, like my heart pounding, thinking of every way in which I'm going to fuck this up. And when I got off the subway and I finally got cell phone service, I had this email that said, "Hi, David. Hi, Ben. I think you should meet." And I had no idea that this was going to be with David Remnick.
An editor at The New Yorker. He's an editor there.
So I went to meet him a few days later. He was incredibly kind and warm and non-judgmental of my inexperience, though healthily skeptical of it. And, you know, I had a grant from Columbia to travel to Belgium, so The New Yorker didn't have to make it an assignment. They didn't have to front the costs. There wasn't really a risk for him to essentially give me a chance.
Mm-hmm.
And so he very kindly said, you know, go, stay in touch with me. Call me if you have any questions. Here's a letter of accreditation in case you need to get into the courtroom. And, you know, be very careful and good luck. And so I went and I just went from parent to parent, focusing on Dimitri Bontink, who was the one I'd met at the Syrian border and who became my guide to meeting other parents, because a lot of parents, quite reasonably, were very nervous about talking to journalists about their children, were quite afraid of being totally screwed over and exploited, as some of them had been by the local press.
Do you think there was an aspect of your being their, some of their children's age?
Yeah, to be honest, I think that helped. I was the age of some of their children. At the time, I was 23. I also, because I had lived on the border and because I had contacts in northern Syria, I was able to help some of them trace their children's roots and help them find out things about their children that their children had hidden from them. Basically, a lot of it was spent reporting for my story,
mm-hmm.
but then a lot of it was also spent just sitting down with parents and telling them I'm sorry and going through completely off the record all the photographs and materials that they had to try to trace what had happened, just piecing it together to give them some peace of mind.
And how did that reporting process feel to you? I mean, you've obviously, at this point, you've done research and, you know, you've talked to a lot of people. It sounds like you're very good at talking to people who you might approach at any time, you know, on the Turkish-Syrian border or what have you. But I could imagine, I mean, there's all these tricky things about on the record, off the record. There's tricky things about what you can use and mm-hmm. and finding your ways inside an institution, a place where you don't really speak the language. Mm-hmm. Did you feel comfortable, like, this is me, like, I know what I'm doing here? Or did you feel like, I'm just trying to do what I can do every day? Like, what was your approach?
I was largely guided by the absolute looming terror of facing what I had heard about from the New Yorker fact-checking department. And so I thought, I need to have absolutely everything on tape. I need to... I went way too far. I mean, just because I had no idea what to walk into, and so I wanted to be really prepared. So I photographed street signs of a certain town being like, I can prove to you that I spoke to this parent who's from Kortrijk because here's a photo of the local train station in Kortrijk that has the metadata showing the date and the time that I was there.
It may have been too far, but I'm sure the fact checkers loved that.
The fact checker who was assigned to the piece became my best friend. We spent a lot of time together, and he's one of my best friends today. And so the same went for On the Record, Off the Record. I thought if any person in the fact-checking process suggests that I had been deceptive or I had told them I wasn't going to use something and then I did, like, that's it. My career is totally over. I'm going to be burned forever. I'll never be able to write, not only for The New Yorker, but for anyone ever. I just had this utter fear. And so I was very clear with people about what I was doing. And that's something that I'm no longer quite so terrified of the process, but I still am very, very, very clear with people about this is going and this isn't.
Well, it's also, that strikes me as one of the, I mean, there's a lot of amazing upsides to sort of starting at the top in terms of a quality publication that does amazing things and doing your first stories basically for it. But there's a downside, which is that people are looking for you to make a mistake and they will catch you in a mistake if you make one.
Yeah, but I've now come to really appreciate that because, at the time that the Belgian piece got to the fact-checking process, I had spoken to more than 50 or 60 people. I had more than 100 hours of tape. I had collected several thousand pages of Belgian police documents. And I felt like a complete lunatic because the specific facts that had emerged from all this stuff were specific facts that no other person had. And so that gave me this immense trepidation because I thought, like, what if I'm the only crazy person in the room who thinks this is true? And so to have a very excellent fact checker, his name's Nicholas Niarchos, go through everything and call up everyone I'd spoken to and go through the documents and determine not only that the facts were correct, but the context was correct, that the, you know, everything that goes into a story that you can get wrong. And there were a couple of things that he corrected or softened, and there were a couple of things that he was able to get that I wasn't. For instance, I knew that Yeyun, the guy profiled in the piece, I knew that he had very briefly fought on the front lines after he was released from captivity by ISIS. But I couldn't source that, and I couldn't get anyone to say it on the record. So it was only during the fact-checking process that Nick called up Yeyun's lawyer and said, look, you know, we're pretty sure he fought. Do you dispute that? And the lawyer said, well, you know, he fired a grenade out of boredom, not out of anger. And so we use that in the piece.
Yeah, it's in the piece. Yeah.
So, you know, every step along the way, the fact-checker made it better. And I've come to really appreciate that at the time that the piece comes out, I no longer have this terror of being completely wrong.
Right.
Because someone else has gone through and figured out that at least what's staying in there is good.
Have you encountered, I mean, you're very young to be doing this type of work in particular, this like foreign correspondent type work. You're also addressing one of the biggest issues today that people are really concerned about, but have a difficulty like grasping and getting into. And have you encountered either condescension or resentment on the part of other reporters or people you encounter for the fact that you are the age you are doing this work?
My experience has been extremely positive in that I've only received encouragement from people. I've had a lot of guidance and help from really experienced reporters who have helped me along the way. While I was working on the ISIS stuff, I became close friends with Rukmini Kalamaki, who gave the best long-form interview I've ever heard. But she and I were having coffee like right before she got on the subway to come that day. That's how I learned about long form, actually, because she was about to go.
That's a great interview.
And I had started off as like partially a source when we were trying to figure out the abduction stuff. And then we became close friends, and then she became a mentor, and she guided me all the way. She, in fact, for the next project that I'm plotting out right now, logistics for, it's in West Africa where she used to work for 7 years. And so she's helping me like sort out security and logistics and stuff for that. So I've been very lucky in that, like, I haven't experienced any resentment. I've been very grateful to have a lot of help and a lot of guidance from people. And a lot of people are doing much more serious work on a much more aggressive time scale than I've been doing, who are also my age. I don't really like talking about myself. Can we move on to like the stories themselves?
Yes, we can. So you've done a bunch of coverage of ISIS in Syria online, but you've written two of the longer features, like magazine features, one about Syrian doctors, mm-hmm. one about the Assad files. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you a little bit about both of those. Sure. I'm curious, once you had the first, did the Assad files, did that come to you, or is that something you were tracking for a long time trying to get a hold of?
I had thought I might try to profile a prosecutor. His name's Stephen Rapp, and he used to be the U.S. ambassador at large for war crimes, and he had spoken very passionately about accountability in Syria, both during his tenure and after he resigned. And so I got in touch with him initially to talk about accountability and to talk about the Caesar photographs, which is this large collection of police images that were taken by a Syrian photographer for the military police to document the corpses of detainees who had been killed in security and intelligence facilities. And on my very first phone call with him, he mentioned that there was a group of investigators who had smuggled 600,000 Syrian government documents out of the country. And I had never heard of this. So I asked if he could tell me a bit more. And by chance, the head of that group, called the Commission for International Justice and Accountability, was coming to Washington. And he agreed to meet up for drinks. So I went down to Baltimore because Bill Wiley, the head of the group, despises everything within the Beltway. So he wanted to stay in Baltimore, even though his meetings were in Washington. And we sat down for 3 hours, and they had already been written about in The Guardian, but they hadn't allowed anybody to look at the actual evidence. And there were some... It was complicated to arrange that. For one, I couldn't mention what country they were based in the piece, for security reasons. Mm-hmm. So I told my editor, Willing, about this, and he was very encouraging, and basically the next week I took off for Western Europe. It was a really strange and lonely time. Because of the arrangements and precautions to protect their organization
and its location, and
I couldn't make any friends. I couldn't talk to anyone who wasn't related to the story. So for 2 months, I hid in an apartment. I had one friend who lived in the city who was also a criminal investigator and prosecutor, so I could talk to him. So I saw him all the time, and then apart from that, I was just all the time in the offices of the CIJA. It was a very lonely time, but it was also quite traumatic, because I was going through these documents, huge volume of documents, and taking notes on them. I can't go into the specifics of that arrangement, but they gave me access to everything I need.
Did you have to have them translated?
No. So because this group intends to supply all the evidence to an international prosecuting body, they had everything translated to a legally viable standard.
Oh, wow.
So I was so lucky because everything I looked at was in English. They had the Arabic copies too, so that I could see that this was, this matched up, and that, there's an Arabic speaking fact checker at The New Yorker from Egypt who would also be aware that, here's the Arabic if you want to double check us.
Yeah. So you're just spending your life in these documents. I mean, it is similar. Yeah. It's related to the question about the Syrian doctor's story, which was, that story sounded like it had videos that were absolutely just
horrific
and devastating. And in this case, it's, torture files essentially.
Yeah.
And so what did that do to you?
Yeah. Well, just on the torture piece, there's hundreds of witness testimonies just detailing the absolute worst thing. And the worst, kind of the part that's most traumatic about it is not not necessarily the specifics of any individual case, no matter how horrific the crimes that happened to them, and no matter how many dead inmates and friends and family members they saw, it was the fact that all of these testimonies taken together corroborated each other and showed a picture of the hell that it really is. Because a single testimony is hard to believe. 10 testimonies saying the same thing, still hard to believe. Hundreds from all over the country saying exactly the same methods being used on them, regardless of the security branch, the exact same methods of transportation between branches, the exact same people in charge of these branches. It started to build a picture so that it was immediately possible to tell what was true and what was hard to know.
Mm-hmm.
And then after working in these files for several weeks, I met Mazen al-Hamada, who was a victim of torture, who wasn't one of the witnesses for the Sija case, but whose story was honestly the most horrific I've ever heard. And it connected databases in an incredibly unique way, which is to say, he happened to be from Deir ez-Zor, which is a city in eastern Syria where the Sija happened to have its largest collection of files. So it was very easy to match up his testimony from his time in Deir ez-Zor with the actual security committee meeting minutes from the Deir ez-Zor security committee that's discussing the mosque that he's organizing protests in real time or contemporaneously. And then he also happened to be transferred to branches in Damascus where he was tortured horribly. And the Sija has incredible testimonies from these branches in Damascus. And then he also happened to very briefly be sent to a military hospital, Hospital 601 in Damascus, which is where the bodies were being processed and where most of the Caesar files, photographs, were taken. And he saw bodies there and he bodies in the bathroom.
Yeah.
He saw this absolute nightmare. This absolute nightmare world that then, upon his release, he detailed in full testimony to a group of Syrian activists who published it with a dateline. And that dateline was October 2013, which was before the Caesar files were known to exist. And so I knew that he wasn't lying about what he saw about the bodies in the bathroom at Hospital 601 because he couldn't have been influenced by the Caesar files because no one knew about that.
Right, it was more, he was corroborated by
everything
that
about his narrative was really unique. I mean, honestly, the most unique thing is that he survived because almost everyone who went to Hospital 601 was killed. And so the fact that we have a witness who made it through Hospital 601 who also happened to connect these other databases was really lucky. And he was also put in touch with me by Stephen Rapp. Stephen Rapp had, before becoming the ambassador for war crimes, he was a prosecutor for years. He is very familiar with doing intense witness interviews, cross-checking them, and he knows the serious stuff so well. And so it was only after Rapp had grilled Mazen for 5 or 6 hours one day that he called me up and said, I have the guy that needs to be in your story. And then I went and I spoke with Mazen for 3 hours. He and I cried, the translator cried. And after that, I was in this hotel in the darkness and the wind and the cold and the rain, just so haunted and so hurt because everything that Mazen told me lined up with stuff I already knew. And so I knew he was telling the truth. And he has this very fragile frame and this very hollow face from having been starved and having been beaten. And he undergoes physical therapy for his wounds. He's 38 years old. And he's so sweet and so honest and so consistent in his facts. And I went to the hotel bar and just like, I called my family and I just cried. And I had nightmares working on that piece for the ensuing couple of months. And then when it came out, it was this enormous relief because I no longer had to hide it all in my head. I like working on these long stories because, it's a real luxury to be afforded the time. You know, a lot of the stuff in the war crimes piece in terms of the broad facts of crimes against humanity, torture and detention centers, these have been reported widely. Mm-hmm. I'm not the first person to do this. A lot of people have been doing it for years. But what I was allowed to do was spend 7 months on this and then write it for 10,000 something words. And that meant I felt as though I was able to tell it more or less completely. But one day, about a week before it ran, I went to my editor, Willing, and I asked him if he thought we might translate it into Arabic. And the New Yorker had never translated a piece before. And he immediately said, yes, let's try to do this. And he proposed it to David, who immediately also said, go for it. And so we had a translation come out about a day and a half after the English showed up. Mm-hmm. And it circulated all over the Arab world. And it was something that felt important to allow Syrians who knew better than anyone what was happening, but maybe hadn't seen the internal security memos mm-hmm. detailing why this was happening to them, to be able to read what was happening in Assad's highest level security committee, how they were coordinating the crackdown in distant provinces, and why it was that their relatives had been tortured and killed.
And now you have, in three cases, gone sort of deep inside this country and what's happened there without having been there.
Yeah.
You've never been in Syria still, or
I
have you been in?
I crossed very briefly in 2013 on my very first trip. So I had gone like barely, you know, yeah. I was 300 meters into Syria. I was never in the firing line. I was never on the front lines. I have never been to Aleppo, and the doctor's piece takes case primarily in Aleppo. So as you mentioned, the doctor's piece relied heavily on videos. And that's something that sort of a method that, and it's more than an accidental method than a deliberate one that's kind of emerged out of these last three pieces, is that rather than going to a place that I cannot safely go in order to witness who knows what for a few hours or a few days or a few weeks, what I did was get access to enormous volumes of proprietary information that someone else had gotten that wasn't otherwise going to be public, that they didn't mind being public, or in the case of the Belgian stuff, just happened to already be leaked and had been published in the Belgian press. Mm-hmm. And that stuff shows infinitely more than I could ever find on my own. Instead, since I was profiling this Dr. David Knott, he had, because he was working to try to train surgeons who work in other conflict zones, he filmed everything. He often had a GoPro camera on his forehead as he mm-hmm. did these surgeries. He came out of Syria over three trips, over 3 years, with more than 50,000 photos and videos. And so I went through them. And there were other things that were really deeply traumatic in that material, stuff that haunted David Knott more than his cumulative 20 years of working in other conflict zones all over the world. Cases where people would come in still alive. There was nothing to do to save them. A lot of them were children. And he said, as he started to cry in the interview, all you can do is hope that they die quickly. And one of these particular scenes was that he filmed was five siblings who came into the ward after a barrel bomb attack. There was a baby with no feet who let out a stifled cry and then died. Nearby on another table, there was his brother whose guts were spilling out of his abdomen, who was silent and unmoving. There was a little boy who was just screaming, who had a little bit of blood on his forehead. He was the only one who lived. And Knott said this harrowing thing that I didn't put in the piece, which is essentially that when you have a child come in and they are screaming, you know they're going to live. And if you have a child come in and they're catatonic, they're the ones who are going to die because they've sort of passed this plateau of bleeding out, and they can no longer, you know, I don't want to get the medical stuff wrong, but essentially they cannot express the pain that they're enduring. And so this other boy gets dragged in two loosely connected pieces, carried by two medical workers, put on a table, flipped over. You can't tell what's front and what's back. His entire pelvis is missing. There's just a... there's a piece of flesh connecting them, and then boy flips over, and he's covered in dust, and his face is gray, and his eyes are looking around, and he's still alive. And there's these little white blobs on his head, and Knot starts scraping them off of his head and sort of petting him and trying to make him comfortable. There's no morphine in the hospital, so there's no way to make them comfortable other than hope they die fast. And Knot didn't know what these little white blobs were until the sister was brought in, and a concrete block had fallen on her head, and these little blobs were the sister's brain. And that scene was something that I had to watch several times in order to write it accurately and carefully, that one of the fact checkers had to watch as well, that Knot replays in his mind over and over and over. And it was the scene that was haunting him most when he went to Buckingham Palace 3 weeks later for lunch with the Queen that he'd been invited to.
That's an insane moment in that piece.
And she asked him whether, you know, what, because she does this lunch, I don't know the time scale, but a few times a year or maybe once a year with citizens. And each of them has some special, you know, quality. And on Knot's right was the Queen, and on Knot's left was one of Britain's most prolific growers of rhubarb. And when the Queen turned to him and asked, like, who are you? Like, what have you been doing? He says, well, I'm a surgeon, and I just got back from Aleppo. And she goes, how was it? And this scene of the children dying in front of him, with him being unable to do anything, was what just filled his mind. And he froze, and he couldn't speak to her. And he was about to cry. And she called over the two corgis and invited him to pet the corgis. And so for the next 20 minutes, he and the Queen are petting her dogs silently. And she closes the lunch with turning to him and just saying, that's much better than talking, isn't it? It really was.
So how do you keep from getting hardened? You seem like an extremely sensitive person. How do you keep from getting cynical or getting, overexposed too quickly to all of this?
I don't think it's my place to be cynical, because I've observed some of the horrors of the Syrian war through these various materials. It's Syrians that are living them. It's Syrians that are being largely ignored by the international community and by a lot of political attention on ISIS. And I think that it wouldn't be my place to be cynical when some of them still aren't. And I recognize that my role is to report what happened as carefully, accurately, and stoically as possible, without diminishing the horror and without exaggerating it, either of which would do a disservice. I'm very affected by each of these stories. I would be afraid of myself if I didn't feel something when I look at videos of dying children. And I went, after that piece came out, I needed a break. I went to California for 6 days and basically just hung out and didn't, the sort of motto for the trip, which I had in mind and I stuck to, was no Twitter, no Trump, no Syria.
I like that your break was 6 days. I thought you were going to say 6 weeks.
It was a nice break. It was a really nice break. I was in the woods and I went to the beach and hung out with my friend. So
I've kept you here a really long time. I could talk to you all day, I think. But I'm going to ask you a couple more things real quick. One is just, there's a certain pull in all of these things to sort of become an expert. Like I noticed in, you know, something happens in Paris, something happens in Nice, something happens in Belgium. Obviously, an editor is going to call you up and say, what have you got to say about this? You've been there. You've got some expertise. But do you feel the pull of the sort of ISIS expert, like people coming at you with that?
I'm very skeptical of that.
Yeah.
I basically, in the aftermath of a terrorism attack in Europe, there's a pretty good chance I'll get an email. I don't write about all of them, and I always feel very reluctant to approach any of them, honestly. I have this fear and concern that ISIS has really perfected its media approach and that we contribute to its expansion and to the proliferation of future attacks.
Rukmini talks about this.
Yeah, and I think it's especially pronounced now as Europe is more and more on edge. So basically what ISIS has done is it has created this framework for anybody to claim affiliation right before doing an attack. And the instructions are to make it public. So a Facebook post, or as Omar Mateen did in Orlando, make a phone call to the police announcing your intentions. That phone call is public record. Of course, it's going to get reported. Because it's getting reported, even though, or even if, he and anyone else who does an attack has never been in touch with a single person in ISIS, by it being reported in the international press that he made this phone call, ISIS finds out about it. Then ISIS claims him, therefore affording him this ideological certainty that, by all accounts, it seems he didn't really have. It also guarantees more press for his atrocity. It guarantees that any loser can be spoken about by presidents and world leaders by not carrying out a massacre, but by carrying out a massacre in the name of a terror group.
Mm-hmm.
And I have this real concern about how we approach this and how we allow the group to proliferate its links and allow domestic abusers and psychopaths to rend apart Western civilization and force intolerance upon actual Muslims in the countries they reside. And I think that it is really deeply important for reporters across the board and politicians, however unreceptive many of them may be to this, to just be so careful about framing, about even using the word terrorism, about using the word ISIS, and in the case that you do, explaining all the ways in which something is or isn't incoherent.
Mm-hmm. So what, now that you've got this journalism under your belt and you also, you know, there's an outlet in The New Yorker that undoubtedly wants more of these stories from you, like what's driving you at this point? Like, what are you driven by, your curiosity in areas that are maybe outside of writing about Syria, or what's going to take you into your next stories and where you want to go next?
Sometimes I'm driven by moral outrage, as I think was the case for some of the war crimes stuff. Other times, well, I don't have that much data to base this on because I've only really done three pieces.
Three's a trend.
I think that I am looking outside of Syria for the next project. I'm attracted to things that might take a while. I think one of my favorite things about journalism is that, and particularly long form, is that it allows you to learn about some of the most interesting things in the world, or the things that interest you most in the world, from the people that know them best. You know, I want to learn about battlefield medicine. I get the opportunity and an open door to speak to one of the world's best war surgeons. I want to learn about war crimes. because of journalism, not because of anything else, I'm allowed to walk into this office that I shouldn't be allowed to walk into. That's what I love most, is just being able to learn about things that excite me or interest me or outrage me from the people who know more than anyone, and then trying as carefully and desperately as possible not to get it wrong and not to oversimplify whatever world that they live in, because they have been generous enough to allow me into it for however many weeks or months. And also the fact that projects do take weeks or months, and potentially in some cases years, but those have a concrete beginning and an end. And I'm a pretty restless person, and I can focus on something for quite intently and obsessively for a period of time, but then when it's done, I can release it from my head, and I almost forget everything. Like, I don't remember most of the details of the Belgium story, or as soon as the war crime stuff was out, you know, I did a couple of interviews after that, and then I basically forgot everything. Same with doctors, I just let it go from my mind. And I like working on projects that, or just having a potential career and a potential life of having this luxury of shifting between things every few months as you get bored or frustrated or confused or lost or curious about something else.
Ben, thank you.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed it.
Oh, me too. Thank you so much for having me on.
That's it for this week's Longform Podcast. I'm your co-host, Evan Ratliff. I want to thank Ben Taub for coming in for that conversation. And I also want to note that some of his reporting for the Assad Files, which was the New Yorker story about the Syrian torture files, was sponsored by the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting. They're a great organization. They've actually funded some stories for the Atavist magazine as well. And he wanted me to make a special note to appreciate their assistance on that front. I want to thank my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer. I want to thank our editor this week, Janelle Pfeiffer, and our intern, Courtney Harrell. We'll see you next week.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon, taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.